Hello, my name is Coda Vance, and welcome to The Affairist Current. As always, our email is theaffairistcurrent@gmail.com, our blog, theaffairistcurrent.blogspot.com. Today, we're going to bring you, moving back from our bonus episodes that we do sometimes. We're going back on a regular track, but sometimes I do when I'm going to talk about a topic that I don't necessarily have a I'm not necessarily as well informed on as I'd like to be. I bring on a guest who has some really specialized knowledge. So if you remember our episodes about Korean politics with Alex and Junte, this is going to be kind of similarly structured to that, more of an interview type format where I'm going to ask some questions to our guest about a topic that you might be maybe a little bit familiar with, but maybe doesn't necessarily get represented in the mainstream media here as well as it could be, to kind of elucidate some things that are going on. So I have with me today William Onyeadju, I'll let him introduce himself.
Yeah, as Carter said, my name is William Onyeadju. I completed a master's degree at Carleton with a degree in political science, specialization in African studies, and mostly my research focused on Nigeria, which I believe is the topic of today.
Yes. Yes. So today, we're going to be, as Will said, we're going to be talking about a broad kind of overview of, I guess, the current and historical political situation in Nigeria. So we're going to try to make this kind of, hopefully, a free-flowing conversation about this, which we'll kind of see where things go. So I guess the first thing I want to start off with is, some people, might know a little bit about Nigeria. Maybe they've heard about Boko Haram. Maybe if you go a little further back, maybe they know about Ken Saro Wiwa, the activist there. But I guess to start out, could you maybe walk us through what the kind of general political geography of Nigeria looks like? What are the key lines of kind of social division, and maybe give us a bit of history about how we come to where we are today?
Yeah, sure. So I guess before I get started on that pretty big question, I just want to say that my major research paper focused on the conflicts which Goodluck Jonathan, the former president of Nigeria from 2011 to 2015 officially, the conflicts that he waged both in the Niger Delta and in the Northeast against Boko Haram. But aside from that, political geography. It's very interesting that you asked that question, because I guess if Nigeria is ever spoken about in media or in layman's terms to people, usually there's a classification of a Christian South and a Muslim North as like the broad dividing lines. And I personally think that those dividing lines lack a lot of nuance for a number of reasons. Largely because there are large Muslim minorities in parts of southern Nigeria, and large Christian minorities in parts of northern Nigeria. And aside from that, I mean, I guess that also doesn't necessarily give people a clue into various ethnic ties that people have, linguistic ties, etc., or the types of religions that people practice, whether it's different branches of Islam, etc. But that's what most people utilize when they discuss Nigeria. But I think in modern-day thought, people like to describe Nigeria as having six major geopolitical zones: the northwest, the north-central, the northeast, the southwest, the south-south, and the southeast. And this is a country which is very hard to describe in terms of divisions. There's over 250 ethnic groups, largest country in Africa, close to 200 million people now. Very cosmopolitan, very hard to describe. But I guess you can utilize those terms in terms of the north and the south broadly. And I guess I might be lazy in this interview by using those terms too, but forgive me. But yeah, those divisions. Religion is another factor in religion in division. I think roughly half of Nigerians are either Christian or Muslim. Has led to a number of various conflicts in the past 15 years especially. Ethnicity, as I mentioned, all sorts of ethnic groups exist in Nigeria. As some people might know who are listening to this program, there's a secessionist movement in southeastern Nigeria for the Igbo people, who, or some of them, want to leave Nigeria and form the African Republic. And there's a civil war fought in the late 1960s, which killed 1 to 3 million people over this issue of ethnic secession. And aside from that, there's tensions which exist in terms of class, gender, of course, sexuality, all sorts of things. So Nigeria is as diverse and as complex a society as any other.
Mm-hmm. So I guess the question that I would ask from that is maybe, you know, you talked about this division that people use between the North and the South. What are the kind of characteristics of that division? You talked about religion a bit and ethnicity as well, but are there other factors? Like if you go to the North of Nigeria, is it a distinct society from the South? Is it distinct economically, socially, and, you know, kind of vice versa?
Sure. I guess we'd have to delve into history to talk about Northern Nigeria. Much of Northern Nigeria was conquered by the Fulani ethnicity in the early 19th century during a series of jihads, the Fulani jihads, as they are called in historical terms, between 1804 and 1808. And so most of Northern Nigeria was under one political entity, which was conquered by the British Empire in the early 20th century. I believe between 1900 and 1903 was when the Sokoto Caliphate was conquered. And then even after that, it was ruled as a separate colony from southern Nigeria until they were amalgamated in 1914. And as part of British policy for ruling northern Nigeria, they tried to both aid northern elites in terms of governing the state after their conquest, and they also tried to insulate the north. This is because they used a policy called indirect rule, in which they would utilize local indigenous aristocrats or elites to govern instead of them governing the colony directly, because at the time the colonial governor Lord Lugard thought that European ways of life or governance were alien to Africans and that it would corrupt them, some nonsense like that. So as a result of that policy being the case, the north was insulated to ensure that these elites would stay in power, and that led to very interesting trajectories in terms of education, for instance, because the South didn't have this policy, and as a result, they were westernized and Christianized, and that led to religious schools and access to Western education. The North not having that particular sort of thing up until maybe the mid-20th century or the 1930s or so led to vastly different rates in terms of literacy, which exists to this very day. For instance, in the northeast of Nigeria, where Boko Haram originated from, there's an adolescent literacy rate of less than 50%. Like adolescent literacy, not even adult literacy rates, right?
Interesting, okay.
Which is quite unfortunate, but some trajectories in Nigeria were created long before the present Fourth Republic of Nigeria, which started in 1999 officially.
Okay, so I guess maybe to go a little bit deeper on that is, what was the distinctness of the policy in the South, and why did that form? Was it because were missionaries involved? Was it just they ruled the colony in a different way because the governorship there was different? Are there distinct reasons for that? And then I guess the other question would be, when it was amalgamated into one colony and then subsequently became independent, were there attempts to kind of, do some of that education and you know, do some of that infrastructure development in the north subsequently?
Yeah, sure. So in terms of just speaking of missionaries, parts of southern Nigeria had been used to a missionary presence since the mid-19th century, often, interestingly enough, led by former enslaved people who had converted to Christianity for a variety of reasons.
And were they coming from America, or were they coming from, like, other British colonies, or kind of both?
Some came from Sierra Leone,
which was, of course,
the British equivalent of Liberia.
Yeah.
Some others came from the Caribbean, especially in the late 19th century, early 20th century. Others were just indigenous Nigerians or people who had become Nigerians who, found Christ, in some way or form. And so, yes, there's a missionary presence for a while before the amalgamation of southern Nigeria. And because, you know, in order to read the Bible, you need to often learn a script. And that script was often in a Latin or a Roman script, whatever it's called, that led to a difference in education compared to the North, which was insulated because of anxieties that colonial governors, and I guess to an extent, Northern elites had regarding Westernization and the effect it would have upon their governing structures. But in addition, I think your second question involved development and literacy. Of course, there were efforts made post-1960 when Nigeria became independent to educate vast parts of the North However, compared to the South, there is a vast stark difference. I think largely because of those historical trajectories which happened a long, long time ago.
Oh.
Adding to maybe perhaps factors regarding developmentalism within elites as well, but I guess we can get to that later.
Okay, well, maybe let's expand on that right now. Do you mean that there are differences in the manner of elite governance at this time, when Nigeria becomes independent? Are there differences in terms of the elite governance in the North versus the South? Because I think, something that people might be aware of is that the South has a pretty big oil wealth that's often seen as the kind of engine really powering the Nigerian economy, whereas the North doesn't really have that natural resource wealth there. So because of that, did differences, I guess, emerge in the way that independence was going to be managed between the North and the South, or different conceptions that people had of, okay, now that we're an independent country, what do we want to do, and how do we want to go forward from there?
I think the governing structures, or the pathologies of elites between the North and the South around independence, were similar in some ways, but we also have to remember that elites within regions of the country were not of one mind, right? There were socialists, which existed in northern Nigeria, which were quite different from traditional aristocrats. Of course, the people in southern or parts of southern Nigeria weren't all the same bent. There was different political parties, such as the Action Congress. Other ethnic groups had formed their own local political parties as well to advocate for their own interests because of their own anxieties. So there isn't one pathology, right? I think that's important to remember. But I think, by and large, there were similarities, but they weren't wholly the same, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
But in regards to oil didn't necessarily become a factor in Nigeria up until, let's say, the mid-1960s.
Okay.
It was discovered, I believe, in 1956 in the Niger Delta. And the profits that Nigeria could have accrued from oil didn't really occur up until the beginning of the Nigerian Civil War. And, of course, there was the oil boom in the early 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
So anxieties regarding oil before or just after independence weren't necessarily big factors up until the destruction of the First Republic.
Okay. So maybe, so let's kind of expand on that point. How does the discovery of oil really change the divisions in Nigeria? Because you mentioned that there are different political parties at that time, but I guess the question I would ask there is, are these parties, you mentioned some of them are kind of regionally based and
At the time they were, okay.
But I guess the question is, how does maybe oil change that relationship or change the way that the political geography of the country is structured? Because if I'm hearing you right, you have a situation where already the South is a little bit more developed, a little bit more educated than the North of Nigeria, and now we find oil in the Delta. So how does that kind of change things moving forward?
I think, by and large, oil basically changed the political economy of Nigeria. I think it's also important to note that Nigeria is an entity which was formed through a process of intense colonial violence in the 19th and 20th centuries, largely for the economic interests of foreign British imperialists.
Yeah.
Arguably.
So can I just ask, sure. Like, what's going on economically before oil? What are the exploited elements, let's say, in Nigeria before we find oil in the Delta?
Yeah, usually there's a huge agro industry going on at the time.
Okay.
People would grow cotton, and they would grow groundnuts or peanuts in the north, and that was exported. Cocoa was a major export in what is western Nigeria, and palm oil was a product of the Niger Delta and of southeastern Nigeria. So okay. majorly, agro industry was a thing. And then tin, of course, was also mined, on top of a few other smaller resources like gold.
Okay.
But oil becomes the center of Nigeria's political economy. And when that happens, according to some people, later on in the 20th century, like Kensler Wiwa, it came to appear that there was an indigenization of imperialism towards parts of Nigeria because they felt marginalized due to the nature of Nigeria's political economy after oil became a factor in which oil resources would be utilized to not only create power and wealth for Nigerian elites and the state itself, but they would also be utilized for regions outside of the oil-producing areas, often to the detriment of these areas.
Okay, so go ahead.
No, it's okay. I think I should add to that that when oil becomes the political economy of a country, a number of decisions are made, and there's a number of negative repercussions, such as Dutch disease, which significantly affected Nigeria. A number of interesting things, if I can use interesting in quotations, happened as a result of that.
Okay. So I guess when you say I'm interested in that phrase that you used, it was indigenization of imperialism within Nigeria. So can you maybe expand on what the people who would use that term mean? Because are you saying that they're kind of drawing an analogy to this previous kind of resource exploitation by the British, and now it's just we're being ruled from Lagos or Abuja now? Is that the kind of thing that they're drawing, is like, still we have this resource and we don't get to benefit from it? Is that what they're kind of saying?
In regards to oil, yes, some would say that.
Okay.
In which, in the First Republic, the oil derivation formula was 50% to the oil-producing region, 50% to the federal government. It became as low as 1.5%, I believe, during dictatorships which existed from the 70s to the 1990s. Now it's currently at 13%. And there's a saying in which the oil-producing areas get only 13% of the resource wealth, but 100% of the pollution, such as 1.5 million tons of oil dumped into the Niger Delta, which has made areas inhabitable for a region which once depended upon agriculture and fishing for a large part of their livelihood. So there is a belief or a feeling amongst many people within that region that their wealth has been exploited and utilized, and they are marginalized, which has caused a number of things to happen. There was a rebellion in 1966, actually, by a fellow of the name of Isaac Boro, who wanted to form a Niger Delta Republic. That was quashed. And, of course, Kansar Wiwa and his Ogoni movement was another form of agitation against this feeling of marginalization above the Nigerian state when their lands were polluted. The Ogoni people benefited very little from the exploitation of oil by the Nigerian government and oil multinational companies like Shell. And, of course, there was the rebellion in the mid to late 2000s regarding many militant groups which had, to be completely honest, a mixture of both criminalistic and political end goals for their disruption of Nigeria's oil economy and all sorts of other things which happened in terms of violence. But there is a large feeling, I think, in that region of marginalization, of exploitation of their natural resources for little gain for the people who live there.
Mm. So, you know, if I'm hearing you correctly, this has really been, since the discovery of oil there, this has been one of the continual kind of political flashpoints and kind of points at which people are driven to, in some cases, you know, unarmed, but in some cases armed kinds of rebellion in order to try to assert a stake within the broader Nigerian society.
I would say so. In my paper, I tried to make the case that state consolidation by violence was a tool which was utilized not only in the colonial state, but the legacy of that consolidation of the state by violence is carried on in the modern Nigerian state, which has affected all sorts of conflicts, now whether it's in the Niger Delta or amongst different ethnic groups who may not want to be a part of Nigeria, or even regards to Boko Haram in the northeast. So there are long patterns within Nigeria for the current conflicts that it currently faces, I think, anyway.
So if I'm hearing you right, this whole sort of idea of we're going to take this society or this, you know, this land here, which is made up of all these different groups, and the way that we're going to really unify them is through a kind of use of state violence force, and not really building a kind of sustainable political kind of consensus between these different people, but rather, you know, as a legacy of both colonial kinds of violence and the subsequent violence of, you know, the post-colonial state. This has really been a kind of theme of the, let's say, security policy of the Nigerian state, you know, since its really beginnings as the state of Nigeria.
Yeah, I would say so. Of course, during the creation of Nigeria as an entity in the colonial state, there was no consent or consensus for the constituent parts. And Interestingly enough, the current constitution of Nigeria, which was formulated in 1999, was created by the last military dictator of that country. I believe his name was Abdul Salami Abubakar. There was no process like you have seen in South Africa's constitution of 1996, or constitutions in Western democracies like, you know, the United States, Canada, etc. There wasn't really that buy-in from the constituent parts of Nigeria. And a lot of people have said we should have another constitutional convention to restructure the state to have a more autonomous form of federalism. However, there are people who benefit from the current structure of how the Nigerian state is.
So can you maybe just elaborate a little bit on what is the governance structure of Nigeria? You said it's the Federal Republic of Nigeria, so I imagine it's federalism, but you're saying that some people think that there needs to be more autonomy in terms of the federalism. So, you know, is it comparable to Canada? Is it comparable to the United States? You know, how, I guess the question would be, how much autonomy do states have? And then, you know, what are the kind of powers that the federal government retains for itself?
Nigeria's federalism, I would not say, is similar to what you would see in Australia, Canada, the United States. It says it's federalist. Nominally, it appears to be a federal state. There are 36 states in Nigeria. However, it's a unitary form of federalism. I believe this is the case because after the Nigerian Civil War, the military elites who ruled Nigeria thought that if we had a more loose sort of federalism, which existed in the First Republic, that would make the breakup of the state more likely to occur. So the federal structure that Nigeria currently has is not like other federalist countries that we know in the world today. For instance, as I mentioned earlier, natural resources are mostly in the control of the federal states, which give out allocations to other states in the union, tying them in a form of dependence upon the federal government. Another factor to think about is that all land in Nigeria is technically owned by the Nigerian government since the 1979 land decree, which issued this statement. So the sort of federalism that, I guess people in countries like the United States or Canada enjoy is far, far different from what occurs in Nigeria.
So you're saying there's not really a whole lot of autonomy between the, the states can have control over some things, but not very much in terms of what they can do economically, because if you're saying that the federal government technically owns all the land, that's a really key kind of resource. And like you said as well, with the oil formula, we had fights in Canada over, how resources were going to be distributed, and, we still have fights over, the equalization formula and all that kind of thing. But it sounds like, for one thing, in our case, that, we had a constitutional convention to be able to reach some kind of agreement about that, whereas you're saying that this was really just imposed in this very top-down kind of formula.
Yes. Yeah, federalism in Nigeria is flawed. Even, for instance, police is under the purview of the federal government, not states, which also, I guess, brings to mind that the state was very paranoid about the utilization of violence in the state. But yes, federalism in Nigeria is very flawed, and ironically leads to many conflicts within Nigeria, which, make the unity of the country tenuous.
Okay, so maybe let's move on to that question. So, like I was saying at the beginning, probably the thing that people are most familiar about, you only follow a little bit of news about Nigeria, is Boko Haram. But maybe let's speak about what are the security challenges in Nigeria today, and, what factors lead into them. What's the history there?
Okay. There are a number of security challenges that the Nigerian state faces, or thinks it faces. I'll get into the thinking part or the perception part in a bit. I think most people would recognize that Boko Haram is a security challenge for obvious reasons. Millions of refugees fleeing to other countries in northeastern Nigeria around the Lake Chad region. People also in Nigeria would constitute the various militant groups in the Niger Delta who are either stealing oil, called oil bunkering, or blowing up installations or kidnapping oil workers, particularly from foreign countries, as a security threat, because the base of Nigeria's power and wealth is its oil exports. The vast majority of Nigeria's foreign exports are oil. Most of the state budget, the federal state budget, is based upon oil, so that is a security challenge that the Nigerian state perceives. A number of Nigerians would perceive pastoral conflicts between Fulani herdsmen and other agricultural groups all over Nigeria as a state security threat. But in terms of the perception part, the thinking part, it seems like the Nigerian state thinks that Shiites in Nigeria, particularly northern Nigeria, are a threat, leading to the massacre of hundreds of Shiites in December of 2015 in the city of Zaria. They would also constitute new Biafran agitators as a threat, leading to many of them being killed in the spring of 2016, numbering in the hundreds. There's also a video about this in Amnesty International, which I think people might be interested in checking out, about public torture and killings.
We'll link to that, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So there's a number of security challenges, but overall, a number of these security challenges have a have a long history, or one which is part of the problem in Nigeria, in which state security is emphasized over human security or human flourishing, leading to all sorts of problems, including Boko Haram, I make in my my research paper.
Okay, so you kind of mentioned a bunch of things there, so I'd like to go through them. So when you say they perceive these kind of minority groups, like you mentioned the Shia in the north. So I take it when you say that the majority of Muslims in Nigeria are Sunni, or?
Yes, okay. The majority of Muslims in Nigeria are Sunni, following okay. different schools of thought, like Tijaniya, Maliki school, etc.
Okay. So is that kind of I guess, in your opinion, this hostility towards these perceived minority groups, is that part of the legacy of the state consolidation of Nigeria, insofar as, you know, we don't really look at these groups as being part of this, you know, broad ethnic mosaic, but rather they're suspect, they're kind of outside agitators that we don't trust, or is there something else going on there?
I think there's something else going on there, but similar to what you just said. I think, particularly in the Shiite case, they're viewed as an alternate side of power. And state governments and the federal government don't necessarily like alternate sides of power, especially because of what happened with Boko Haram, which started out as a small sect, some would even call it a cult, and violence, became, an interregional conflict as a result of that. So the Nigerian state, I think, currently looks poorly upon alternate sides of power or groups which offer alternate visions of what Nigeria should be or ought to be.
So, and then the next question I have is, when you talked about this idea of state security over human security, so I guess that's the question is, you know, maybe elaborate a little bit on that. When you say that they prioritize state security, it's in saying that, they're not really paying attention to the underlying kind of economic or political or, educational, whatever it may be, factors that lead to somebody joining a group like Boko Haram or joining a group like the the people in the Niger Delta, and this is kind of leading to these conflicts just spiraling over and over again, or are you saying that the prioritization of resources into the military, into the police, has kind of just created a kind of situation where the state doesn't have the kind of resources to be able to spend money on these different projects that would improve, that kind of human security?
I'm saying the former, and what you say, which the state prioritizes notions of state security over human flourishing. I'll give you an example. So let's say a community in the Niger Delta are very upset that they have no running water, very little jobs for the youth, and their lands are polluted to a huge degree, in which people are just having miscarriages because of gas flaring, all sorts of environmental things which should be normally taken care of to promote human flourishing or human security. They protest. The Nigerian army comes in, destroys their village. In that process, what I just explained to you, essentially the Nigerian state is deciding that notions or perceptions of state security, for instance, if someone threatens their access to oil wealth, is far more important to them than doing the structural things which would close inequities and allow Nigerian citizens to have a good quality of life. That's what I mean in terms of that formula.
So is that something that, when you talk about the human security, is that something that, for one thing I would ask is, does that look different in an urban environment in Nigeria versus, like, say, Lagos versus what I think you're talking about are more kind of rural areas in the Delta. Like, I guess, is that part of the issue, is that there's an urbanization of the elites, and they don't really, they perceive these rural kind of areas as just being hostile kind of interlocutors that are preventing the state from accessing resources? Or is it something else that's kind of playing in there?
I think the rural-urban divide is part of it. I mean, Nigerian elites, you know, live in wealthy enclaves if they live in the country. If they don't, they're often in cities like New York, Houston, or London, having a really great time, living off the proceeds of oil wealth. Mm. And this also relates to the Nigerian presidency. Symbolically, Aso Rock, where the president lives, the villa, is very removed from people living, not only in terms of Abuja, but also from the rest of Nigeria. It's a very isolated environment. And I think that symbolically or metaphorically shows or demonstrates how Nigerian elites are removed. But if they perceive a threat to their power or their wealth, I'm sure they're willing to do, and they have been willing to do, a number of things which violate human rights and civil rights in order to maintain the status quo.
So I guess maybe if you could speak to how did this removal of the elite class from the broader public, how did that happen? Is this a situation where you have a kind of post-colonial authority where the people involved in the creation of that authority were people who had been to one degree or another co-opted by the previous colonial government? You also mentioned that in northern Nigeria there was this process of indirect rule where they kind of empowered existing local elites. So I guess, and then you could also maybe, or is there a third factor here of people who have just sort of wormed their way into the tendrils of state power and are, in one way or another involved in these kinds of collusions that you often see in countries which have, a really big resource boom? Or is it all of those things and more things?
All of those things. But I want to make a note. Indirect rule also occurred in parts of southern Nigeria.
Okay.
Not just the north. But a number of those people who benefited from indirect rule in parts of northern and southern Nigeria make up the elite today.
Okay.
But I would say, by and large, there is a patronage-client nexus or network at play in Nigeria, which involves those old aristocrats in both parts. It also involves religious leaders. It also involves elements of the Nigerian military, particularly those who were in charge of Nigeria through the various bouts of military rule in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. And all of those people form a patron-client network, which it's at its source is the ability to access oil rents. And from there, you distribute those monies to gain more access to the state, to gain more connections, and to make sure that your affiliates, whether they be ethnic, religious, etc., also benefit from you being their patron.
So I guess what I'm hearing, something that I am a little bit more familiar with, is the process of kind of post-colonial state authority consolidation in Kenya. And one of the things that people always say about Kenya is one of the biggest kind of problems that came out of the decolonization process was that, public goods, public wealth were not being distributed in a way that was impartial or at the very least, like, attended to balance between different ethnic and tribal groups, but rather people were setting up these kind of patronage networks that favored particular people that they had kinship with. Is that a similar pattern in Nigeria, I would ask that question. Is that a similar pattern in Nigeria?
I'm not entirely sure about the Kenyan example, because, Kenyan's politics are very fascinating in of themselves. I mean, I'm sure tons of people have lots to say about that. Mm. But I suppose it's different in that. It's similar in that sense, in which, some groups have benefited from being part of that nexus of benefiting directly. But note that this is a country which has increasingly grown poorer since the high days of the oil boom in the late 1970s, right? This is a country which over $400 billion, as far as we know, have been stolen since 1960. More than enough money to at least get the basic infrastructure that Nigeria needs to become a developing country or a developed country. Who knows what could have happened if there wasn't that crass sort of corruption. All of those things occurred during various cycles of Nigeria's history, particularly during oil booms. But, you know, as a result of that wealth stolen, as a result of that corruption that I guess we're speaking of, Nigerian people, by and large, haven't really locked down. And so, that's particularly harder in northern Nigeria, where you have poverty rates approaching 80%, particularly in parts where Boko Haram came from.
And so obviously that's a factor exacerbating the kinds of security problems that you create. Although, just out of curiosity, if we compare that to southern Nigeria, what would be the poverty rate there?
I don't have the exact figures on me, but I'm sure they're around half or so of what the poverty rates in certain parts of northeastern Nigeria is.
Okay, so it's very much different in terms of the rate there. So.
Yes, but there are extremely poor people all over Nigeria.
Of course.
But as you just said, you know, that sort of poverty makes people consider alternative visions of the state, and based upon their own identity and how they identify as, some of those visions of the state may be based upon their ethnic group in terms of secession, or radical reformulation of the state in terms of religious lines.
Mm-hmm. So I guess let's kind of speak about one of those visions of a reformulation of the Nigerian state. We're coming up, it's the 50th anniversary of Biafran independence? Or
yeah, the 50th anniversary happened on May 30th.
On May 30th, okay. So very recently. I guess this is, you know, probably if people are familiar with it, with this conflict, but possibly because this is also where Medecins Sans Frontières started from, what was being involved with this in terms of treating people. But can you maybe speak to what were the factors? I think we talked a little bit about it already, but what were the factors that kind of shaped the, you know, movement for Biafran independence and the subsequent civil war? And then also, you know, as we go on, maybe we can speak about how those factors changed and what are people's perceptions on this 50th anniversary.
I'll provide a simple narrative about what led to the Biafran conflict, although I think the simple narrative might, you know, not do it justice, but there's a lack of time.
Yeah.
What happened was, in 1966, there was a coup which overthrew the First Republic of Nigeria, killing many northern elites and elites from western Nigeria in January of 1966. And this was mostly led by officers of the Igbo ethnic group. And the ruling head of state became an Igbo person, although he was not directly involved with the coup in January. There was a counter coup in July of 1966 in which mainly Igbo officers, or officers from eastern Nigeria, as it was then called, were killed by officers mainly of northern ethnic affiliation. And after that counter coup of July 1966, there was a series of pogroms across northern Nigeria which killed around 30,000 people of Igbo ethnicity or people who were from eastern Nigeria, causing more than a million to stream back as internally displaced people or refugees. And so in terms of how the counter coup unfolded in 1966 in July, the government of eastern Nigeria wasn't removed in the counter coup. And so the leader of eastern Nigeria, the military governor, Odumegwu Ojukwu, led eastern Nigeria to form the Biafran state as a bit of independence after a series of failed talks in 1967.
And just to maybe briefly cut in here, roughly speaking, like, what is the geography of this Biafran state? Is it the Niger Delta region, or if you could just briefly sketch?
It includes the Niger Delta region and the five states, which are predominantly Igbo speaking.
Okay.
So yes, that is Biafra. Then there was a brutal civil war fought between 1967 and 1970, which killed 1 to 3 million people. For many Westerners, it was the first time they saw Africans starving. You know, with distended bellies, you know,
yeah,
flies around their
face. Iconic sort of imagery that came out of this conflict, yeah.
Yes, very much so. I think that's where Jello Biafra gets his name.
Yes.
John Lennon gave back his Order of the British Empire over disgust of the conflict.
Yeah.
All these things happened, and the Nigerian state prevailed in the end. They defeated Biafra. And eastern Nigeria was, you know, devastated because of that brutal conflict in which billions starved to death. But since then, people would describe there being a sense of mutedness regarding Biafra. People, I think a lot of people would say that the Igbo people felt defeated. A lot of them had lost their wealth because even if you had millions of dollars in the bank in other parts of Nigeria, and property, after the end of the war, they gave you like, I don't know, a 50-pound note or something like that as compensation for those losses. And as a result of that, there wasn't a lot of talk because a lot of people suffered as a result of the Biafra War. But since then, since 1999, in which Nigeria's political space has widened considerably because this is a new start of a democratic period in the country's history, more and more people have been advocating for a Biafran state because of the current failures of Nigeria to deliver a good quality of life for people. And I guess to an extent, rid itself of perceptions of anti-Igbo prejudice or marginalization, as they like to describe it. So all those factors have, you know, led to various groups which have advocated for the Biafran idea, such as MASUB, or Movement for the Actualization of the Sovereign State of Biafra, and currently IPOB, which is the biggest Biafran movement called the Indigenous Peoples of Biafra.
And are these, like, how many people, I mean, you know, I don't know how closely you can get an estimate, but how big are these groups? Are they substantial in terms of, like, how many people are members of them, and do they have a real concrete political impact right now?
Right. The number in the thousands, okay. Definitely. I can't tell you how many people are in these groups. I'm sure the Nigerian government would love to know. but I think the IPOB group on Facebook has over 100,000 members, maybe something like 300,000 members, which says a lot about their popularity. And I think their popularity is growing because a lot of young Igbo Nigerians are dissatisfied with the current Igbo elite, which currently believes in one Nigeria. And so they're looking for alternative visions so they can have hope in their future. And as such, they're drawn to the Biafran message.
So when you say that they're drawn to the Biafran message, like, is there a sense of... yeah, I don't know how to put this exactly, but is there a sense of, like, you know, loss that is coming from, or not necessarily nostalgia, because many of these people wouldn't necessarily be old enough to remember Biafra being independent, but are they actively looking back to that period and saying, like, we should do that again, or rather it's more, we're just being treated unfairly in the current environment, and we would be better off by ourselves kind of thing?
What I'm hearing, from what I've seen online and from people I've spoken to about this, is that they want a referendum.
Okay. So almost like, it would almost be like Quebec in Canada.
Or Scotland.
Or Scotland, yeah.
They want a referendum.
Okay.
And the Nigerians say, well, probably not give them a referendum. I think President Buhari, the current president of Nigeria, said, if I'm, you know, paraphrasing him, he would rather jump into the sea than see Nigeria break up.
Okay. So I guess we kind of talked about this, but from what I'm hearing from you there, it seems like a lot of the issues that drove the initial independence in the first place, kind of perceived and actual prejudice against the Igbo, mismanagement of natural resource wealth, and the general kind of idea that, I mean, I guess the question I would ask there is, like, is there, from these groups, is there a general, like, is the idea that, like, basically, the Nigerian state as it is currently constituted, like in terms of how wide it is in terms of the geography and the ethnic diversity of it, just cannot work? Is that kind of what they're saying? Or is it rather just this settlement, this constitution does not work, and therefore we need to leave?
I think you were hinting at something earlier before you asked that question, in which there's a continuity. I think there's a continuity in a sense, but in 1967, Igbo people believed that they were going to be killed en masse, like a genocide. In 2017, they just want a separate state because they believe that Nigeria is not working.
Okay.
As Nnamdi Kanu, the leader of IPOP, said, Nigeria is a zoo. Metaphorically speaking, he means that Nigeria is not working, which it basically destroys the human dignity of people living within the Nigerian state. And therefore, they want the ability to self-determine their futures. That's the sense of what I'm getting out of people who advocate for Biafra.
Okay, that makes sense. That makes sense. So I guess the next question is, you know, we mentioned him a little bit earlier, but Muhammadu Buhari, who is the he was elected in 2015, he was elected, yes, to replace Goodluck Jonathan. So I guess what I would ask is, you know, maybe people have voted this guy, maybe they haven't. So first of all, how was he elected? Like, who supported him? What was the kind of policy he was running on? What were his ideas about what the future of Nigeria should look like?
Well, I guess I should give a brief sketch of his life. But before I say anything about him, I just want to let people know that I'm not a fan of Muhammadu Buhari or his economic policies. Muhammadu Buhari was a general in the Nigerian military for a long time. He fought against Biafra during the Nigerian Civil War. He overthrew the Second Nigerian Republic in 1983, in which, according to some scholars, it was the closest Nigeria ever came to totalitarianism. He launched a war against indiscipline, which saw civil servants who were late for work do jumping jacks, which I'm sure would make people in Ottawa very happy and see their tax dollars at work.
Yes,
people
yes.
be forced to queue in long lines. He just wanted to bring his sense of order to the country, even if it was based upon state violence. On top of a number of things which happened during this regime until it was overthrown in 1985. But as a politician, in Nigeria's Fourth Republic, he has contested elections since 1999. And this time he finally won because he and other people, particularly in southwestern Nigeria, such as Tinubu, a politician from that region, formed a political alliance under a new party called the All Progressive Congress. Buhari says he campaigned on fighting corruption and defeating Boko Haram, but his party also had a campaign based upon making sure that the Naira reached the value of the U.S. dollar in terms of currency, providing 5,000 Naira to the poorest Nigerians, all sorts of other interesting, or employing millions of Nigerian youth, none of which have happened, including both defeating Boko Haram and also making dents upon corruption in Nigeria. So what was your original question? Sorry.
So I guess that kind of addresses, like, okay, this is how he won the thing. Although I guess... Was his, because we spoke about the kind of different divisions within Nigeria, you were saying a lot of his support came from the southwest of the country?
And the north.
And the north.
Especially the north.
Okay, so he's from the southwest and the north, and I guess...
From the north.
He's from the north, okay. Yes. And his support is largely coming from the southwest and north. And I suppose, conversely, the support that Goodluck Jonathan had was coming mostly from the southeast, yes?
I'll say it like this. Okay. In the 2011 election, which Muhammadu Buhari contested against Goodluck Jonathan, Buhari lost that election.
Okay.
He won mostly northern states.
Okay.
In 2015, after he formed that political alliance with Tinubu, he won northern states and southwestern states.
Okay.
So his base of support is in the north. For Goodluck Jonathan's base of support, there was a few northern states who supported him in 2011, such as Plateau State and Taraba. But in 2015, his support was largely reduced to the southeast and the south-south.
Okay. Okay. So then the question, okay, so that kind of answers where his support's coming from. And I guess what you were saying is, you know, his platform, such as it was running against corruption, against, you know, the inability of the state to solve the Boko Haram issue, and as well as these kind of what broadly sound to me like sort of state interventionist, almost sort of like Keynesian economic kind of measures, if you want to. I mean, I don't know.
I think that would be giving him too much
credit. That would be giving him too much credit, okay. But at least promises of employment and greater poverty relief and that kind of thing, okay. So since he's been in office, what has he actually done? Because you say he didn't really do any of these things, so what has his rule heretofore consisted of?
Where to start? Where to begin? I think before I get into the nitty gritty of what he's tried to accomplish, he went to London after his election, and he was asked by someone who was, you know, at some talk shop in London about how are you going to solve the issues in the Niger Delta? They're longstanding. They've existed since before you were in power. What are you going to do? Buhari said this. He didn't answer the question, but I think he said something very interesting, in which he said, if I'm paraphrasing correctly, there's videos on YouTube which show this. He said, the people who gave me 5% of their vote should not expect the same as those who gave me 97% of their vote. So a similar thing would be Justin Trudeau going to some place in London and saying, Albertans shouldn't really expect much because I'm Prime Minister of Canada. It would be like Donald Trump, because he's from New York State, saying, people in California should expect little, because I received very little of their votes. Mm. I think that, you know, sets the general
although climate. Although, if we may paraphrase something from Canadian history, why should I sell your wheat?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. what has he done? So, in terms of corruption, there hasn't really been any long-standing institutional creation to fight corruption in Nigeria. Corruption, as I see it, is a pervasive issue that requires the creation of not only institutions to fight these corruptions, but also different sets of behaviors. And although he's postured an anti-corruption attitude, to a certain degree, there have been extra-legal means to go after people who have pilfered perhaps hundreds of millions, if not billions, from Nigeria's state coffers. For instance, there's a person of the name of Sambo Dosuki, who allegedly stole hundreds of millions from the Nigerian state in terms of stealing money from weapons purchases, which should have been for the Nigerian army to fight Boko Haram. There is a court, the Economic Court, sort of the Court of the Economic Community of West Africa, which said that he should be released on bail. Nigerian state has refused that court order, for instance. So I think there is a weakening of the rule of law which comes out of this anti-corruption fight, and I think they'll have negative repercussions for other future anti-corruption fights. In addition to them not being able to successfully prosecute anyone they've allegedly arraigned in court for corruption. But in terms of fighting Boko Haram, as we know, Boko Haram is still not defeated, and millions of people are starving or malnourished in northeastern Nigeria. It's the biggest famine in Nigeria since the Civil War. And they've known about this. The government knew that there was a risk of famine for at least a year before the famine officially began. And when the famine was underway, they tried to prevent, interestingly enough, Médecins Sans Frontières, which, you know, made its name during the Nigerian Civil War, from accessing these sites, from providing food aid to people, probably out of risk of embarrassment to the government and to the Nigerian military as well. So I think those things should be considered. In addition to him giving lip service to economic diversification of Nigeria by utilizing millions of naira to explore possible sites of oil exploration in not only the Lake Chad region, but also in the Gongola River Basin. So it seems like he only wants to diversify oil away from the Niger Delta, but not the Nigerian economy away from oil.
So those sites that you mentioned are more towards the north of Nigeria, yes?
Yes. Okay. And finally, his economic policy. He's pegged the Naira in a time where oil, Nigeria's main foreign export earner, has, you know, crashed in global markets because of the glut, which happened, I think, in 2015 or so.
Yeah.
And because of that, many investors have left Nigeria thinking, well, I'll make more money when the Nigerian Naira obviously falls, which eventually it will, because they don't have that much foreign exchange reserves. They can't support the peg forever.
So what, he's pegged it to the U.S. dollar?
No, he's just pegged it at a rate.
Oh, he's just pegged it at a rate.
Which doesn't reflect the reality.
Okay, so has there been a situation that's emerged, because I know that there's a similar thing in Venezuela right now where you have a similar kind of issue with the oil. Is there there was an official rate and then there's this other real rate?
Yeah, the black market rate is a real rate. So as a result of the discrepancy, people who, let's say you're a manufacturer in Nigeria, and you're making cars. This is actually based on a real scenario. Okay. There's a Nigerian car manufacturing company called Innoson Motors. Okay. They want to buy parts from abroad because there isn't really domestic suppliers for these car parts, so they can, you know, keep assembling vehicles.
Yeah.
You can't buy the official rate. You have to go on the black market rate because of the inability for these companies to act as forex to buy. And because of that, the cost of doing business is far more expensive. On top of all the other difficulties in Nigeria, such as not having steady electricity, relying upon generators, all sorts of other things. And because of these circumstances, a number of manufacturers in Nigeria had to close down operations or lay off workers because they weren't able to import goods from abroad because of currency or forex restrictions, because the main forex earner has crashed in value.
Okay. So I guess the question that kind of comes out of that is...
Plus investor flight, of course.
So I guess the question that kind of comes out of that is, how stable do you think, anyway, Buhari's rule is? Is he at risk of being overthrown? Or, even just in the next election, would he lose? Or what is the feeling around that in Nigeria?
Very fascinating. A year after he came into power, Nigeria had 15.6% inflation, 48% youth unemployment and an economic recession, which is unheard of for a country which, you know, is a developing country, which should grow around 4 or 5% to make sure people were falling hugely back into poverty.
Yeah.
But on top of all of these other things, including, his inability to manage the Nigerian economy, he's been very sick. He's had numerous bouts in which he'd had to leave Nigeria for months to London. And Nigerian people and journalists would ask, what's wrong with him? Where is he? And there'd be a lot of stonewalling, saying he's perfectly healthy, he's very sick, flip-flopping back and forth. And he's currently in London right now. So there was a number of rumors going around earlier in May about a coup in which the chief of staff of the Nigerian military said and warned members of the Nigerian military not to, what was the term he utilized? Hobnob
okay.
with any politicians who are wanting to overthrow Nigeria's Fourth Republic.
Okay. Plus, and this was something that he said, like, openly to the media?
Yeah,
like,
this
okay.
is an open statement.
Okay.
And Nigeria has not an acting president, per se, because of power squabbling going on, but the vice president of the country operates the country right now.
Okay. So this would be, like, I'll give an example that might be familiar to people. When, after Reagan, the attempted assassination against Ronald Reagan, when he was recovering in the hospital, George H.W. Bush was running the show
for
a while.
Or, like what happened in 2010, when the president of Nigeria at the time, Umaru Yar'Adua, died, and Goodluck Jonathan, who was vice president, became acting president mm-hmm. of the country.
Okay.
So things seem to be repeating themselves. Maybe if Buhari passes away, which would be unfortunate for Nigeria's political stability. But that's what's currently going on
okay.
in terms of that. I believe he's still in London. I believe the acting president, or not really acting president,
quote unquote acting president,
Osinbajo is currently governing Nigeria.
Okay,
and that seems to be the case. His presidency seems to a number of people to be a failed presidency. Despite all the hope that people had going in.
So I guess that's the question. Nigeria has really only had, since, as you were saying, since 1999 has really been the only, is that the longest period of continued democratic governance in the history of Nigeria since
yes.
independence? Okay.
Yes.
So I guess the question that will kind of come out of that is how consolidated or not consolidated is that democratic rule? Because, it's just me looking at this, but, if I have the chief of staff of the army openly talking to the media about and warning against a coup, I know he's warning against it, but when you have to do that, I feel it's probably not a very good situation. So do you think that there's a possibility of military rule coming back to Nigeria, or do you think that things have reasonably consolidated themselves at this point?
I don't think military rule is possible at this point. History may prove me wrong, but I think given current trends, the problems that Nigeria has cannot be solved by the current ruling military elite or former ruling military elites like Buhari.
Mm.
Nigeria is a very cosmopolitan, complex country, and I think any new dictator would have a lot of difficulty ruling the country. I mean, look what's going on right now in terms of the Niger Delta, in terms of Boko Haram. A military dictator would have to inherit two conflicts on top of, a declining economy.
Mm. So I guess that kind of leads to, we're coming up on an hour here. I guess that kind of leads to the final question I wanted to ask is, based on the research you've done and looking at this, what do you think the future of Nigeria looks like? Is it more continued kind of conflict between these different regions? Do you think there's a way out of this situation that it finds itself in with these various different sites of power? The question of corruption being there as well. If you have to look at the way the country's going to evolve in 5 years, 10 years maybe, what do you see in the future? Obviously, you can never entirely predict these things. But if we can't do, the crystal ball kind of thing, what are the trends that if somebody is observing Nigeria, what should they be looking at?
I hate crystal balls.
Okay.
I really do. History, sort of the past, the present, the future. Sorry, the future is always very hard to predict.
Future is unwritten.
Is exactly. But I will say this. Nigeria has a number of challenges coming up. Let's look at its population growth. Currently, there's almost 200 million Nigerians. By mid-century, there should be around 400 million Nigerians in the country, the area of California. By 2100, there should be close to 900 million Nigerians.
Wow.
Right. And this is a country which is already struggling to provide public services and goods to 200 million people. How would it be able to do so if the population increases by two in the next 30 years? And on top of that, the basis of Nigeria's power and wealth is oil, a commodity which might lose value over the coming years because of the shale revolution in countries like the United States, or countries which haven't had a shale revolution yet, like Australia, Argentina, and China.
I know Trump just pulled out of the climate accord, but, you know, if we don't want to cook the planet, you know, countries are probably going to have to start shifting away from those kinds of resources.
Yeah, but even if oil is of value, yeah, let's say 2050,
yeah,
Nigeria might be pushed off the oil market because, you know, countries, due to the declining value of oil, have tried to buy up as much of the oil market as possibly they can, like Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
But on top of those things that I mentioned in terms of population growth, on top of oil declining in value or being replaced by alternative fuels, if the things which are causing conflict in Nigeria to exist, both a valuation of perceptions of safe security over human flourishing and utilizing violence as a means of consolidating the state continue, I think it's just going to be harder as the population grows, as things become more scarce. It'll be harder for the Nigerian state to really control the country. So there's a possibility in which Nigeria, in a stark, really bad future, not making any, you know.
Yeah.
But if it might be on a road to, and some people online call this the road to Kinshasa, the DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo, in which the state controls not the entirety of the country's territory, in which the state suffers from bouts of extreme violence, in which millions of people die, in which the state basically is on a permanent path towards state failure. Nigeria might be on that path. It might not be too late. I mean, there might be a possibility in which Nigeria's future reorients itself, you know, considers resource allocations based upon federalism, considers investing more of its people in terms of healthcare, education, invests in infrastructure, solves the electricity issue in which Nigeria generates less power per day than the city of Edinburgh in Scotland. So
really, the entire nation of Nigeria generates less electricity per day.
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
Yes, exactly.
I think it's interesting the thing you mentioned about the population growth. I didn't realize it was growing quite that quickly. And, you know, when you're managing that level of population growth, you have to also have a very high sustained level of economic growth in order to, you know, make sure that people aren't backsliding just as an automatic kind of factor. I mean, I think the states that have managed to keep things on that track, probably China would be the biggest one, even though it's running into some problems recently. You know, the states that have managed to do that, you know, have been the states that, you know, are seen as the rising stars of the global economy. And I find it very interesting because is at this point Nigeria the largest economy in Africa?
Depending on who you talk
to. Depends on how you... Okay, depends on how exactly
because
you
look at it. Because the devaluation of oil affected Nigeria's output, which affected its GDP.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, but it's regardless, it's one or two, basically, depending on how you look at it. It's either that or South Africa. So, you know, this really should be, you know, if it was being managed properly, this really should be a site of rising global, or at least regional kind of power.
Nigeria should be a regional power.
Yeah.
It is in a lot of senses. I mean, it projected power in Sierra Leone, Liberia in the 1990s. It recently projected power in the Gambia. The Nigerian Navy sent a destroyer and its aircraft have deployed a no-fly zone over the Gambia. Mm. It already projects power regionally. It's just that its problems have, you know, hobbled it, which is why it relied upon countries like Cameroon, Chad, and Niger to combat Boko Haram. Mm.
Okay. So I guess, you know, we've got over an hour. So, maybe to close out, is there one thing that you want to tell listeners about, you know, maybe a misperception that people have about Nigeria or something that is really important to keep in mind if we want to think about this country with its history, with its current problems? you know, is if there's one thing that, or one or two things that you think people really should take away from this conversation, what would they be?
I'm assuming most people in this who are listening to this program are not from Nigeria or from Africa.
yes, you can safely assume that, yes.
Cool. I will say two things. Hopefully it won't take too long. First, Nigeria is very important. You know, close to 200 million people. Depending on who you talk to, the first or second largest economy in Africa. A huge diaspora all over the world, including myself. What happens to Nigeria will affect not only West Africa, but the African continent as a whole. So, that also relates to the second thing I want to say, but keep in mind that the fate of Nigeria will affect the fate of the African continent as a whole. Secondly, you live in the West. You live in countries which interact with Nigeria in terms of foreign policy. If you really care about the fate of Africa and that of Nigeria, really examine the decisions that your foreign policy makers are doing. For instance, are they exacerbating existing inter-regional or inter-ethnic tensions or inter-religious tensions by the decisions that they're making? Are they helping policymakers which are causing the problem, such as Boko Haram? Are the companies that you buy oil from, like Shell, are they adding to issues in the Niger Delta? See exactly how you might be contributing to current problems in Nigeria and what you can do as an engaged, compassionate citizen to alleviate some of the suffering, or at least bring light to people who might want to know more about the African continent, especially Nigeria.
Mm. Okay, so I thank you very much for coming on the podcast with me. I hope this was a really fruitful discussion. Obviously,
I hope so too. I missed a lot of stuff. There's just so much to talk about.
I mean, I think you know, books and theses have been written on these topics, and you know, obviously, in the confines of a short kind of conversation, you know, you can't get everything in that you want to get in. And I hope, I mean, you know, perhaps if there are future developments in Nigeria, we could have you on or other things around that kind of
hopefully good news, not bad.
Hopefully good news. We could have you on to discuss those as well. But I do think this has been a very enlightening discussion, and I hope that listeners get a lot out of it because, you know, like I say, when we're talking about this, and I think I kind of made the same point when we had the discussion with Alex and Junte about Korea. You know, there's always a history to things, and when you get only a story and you're not even maybe reading the story, you're just reading the headline, you know, you don't realize that there's a history to this. And, you know, we can talk about maybe in Canada or the U.S., I think we do recognize that when we talk about an incident, there's always a history to it. But when we're talking about a country like Nigeria, we don't recognize that history. Mm-hmm. We don't recognize where things are coming from. We just think, oh, isn't that...
There's an amnesia.
Yeah, there's a historical amnesia. And I think, you know, to the extent that we've done something to correct that, I think this has been a fruitful discussion.
I hope so. I hope I added some things to the questions you asked, or at least I did them some justice.
No, I think that was very good. So we will put some links up to some of the things that we talked about today on the website. I guess maybe one final question would be if people want to know more about Nigeria or more about maybe some of these issues, are there books or news websites or something like that that you would maybe recommend to people?
Sure. Books. There's a Nigerian-born American scholar named Toyin Falola. He's written some great books in Nigeria. I recommend reading his History of Nigeria, written with another scholar, and Colonialism, Violence in the State in Nigeria, which I believe is another book he's written. Also, in terms of Twitter, I really recommend this guy whose name is Onye Nkuzi. I'll spell that for you. O-N-Y-E, then Nkuzi is N-K-U-Z-I.
I will put a link up to that in the show notes as well.
Yeah, I really like his Twitter. He's opinionated. He's obviously biased towards his own region of Nigeria. But I think in regarding a country as complex as Nigeria, everyone will come or approach issues with biases based upon their identities, including me. You know, take what I've said with a grain of salt.
Of course. Okay, well, that's great. So for myself and for Will, I, as always, am Code of Vance. Our blog, we'll have everything, is theaffairscode.blogspot.com. And our email, if you want to get in touch with us, is theaffairscode@gmail.com. And, yeah, I think we've had a very fruitful discussion here today. I hope you enjoyed listening to it, and I hope you have a pleasant week.